There's a pretty interesting film playing in theaters around the country. Written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, it's titled Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and in addition to being the ninth film by the high-profile, quirky director who promised a while back that his filmmaking career would consist of 10 films, it features an all-star cast that includes Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, and Al Pacino, among other high-powered and up-and-coming stars. It takes the viewer back to 1969 Los Angeles with a showbiz-based plot that examines the final days of Hollywood's so-called Golden Age. It loosely mixes fiction with nonfiction and includes a brush with the gruesome Charles Manson family murder that took the life of actress Sharon Tate. All in all, it's gotten good reviews and is doing well at the box office. One of its many assets is the extraordinary job Tarantino and his team did on recreating the look and feel of Los Angeles as we remember it being in that colorful year of 1969, part of which was enhanced by the artistic use of popular music of the day and set within the context of the big top 40 radio station in Southern California at that time, the mighty 93KHJ, also known as Boss Radio, which pops up throughout the film's cleverly rendered soundtrack.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Real Don Steele.
KHJ Los Angeles.
Our guest this week is one of the talk radio industry's most influential media consultants, who's been advising programmers and coaching on-air talent for decades, since serving as a major performer and programmer himself at high-profile East Coast stations such as pop giant WPRO in Providence and all-news beacon WTOP in Washington, D.C. In addition to consulting, he hosts a television show called The Big Picture Weekends on RT America. Our guest saw the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it sparked a flood of thoughts in his fertile brain about the impact of stations such as KHJ back in that era, and a bunch of comparisons of radio back then with radio today. He and I invite you to join us for a deep dive chat between two seasoned radio guys talking about all that good stuff, including jingles, personalities, music, and a medium that could be aptly described as the soundtrack of our lives. Stand by for a lot of fun. Our guest this week is Holland Cook. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll dive right into a provocative conversation with media consultant Holland Cook. But first, a quick programming reminder from Podcast One. Calling all reality TV fans, get your fix with Rob Cisternino on Rob Has a Podcast here on Podcast One. Join the two-time survivor as he talks to some of the biggest names in reality TV and covers the hottest competition shows like Survivor, Amazing Race, Big Brother, and more. Download new episodes of Rob Has a Podcast every week. Okay, here we go. A conversation with media consultant and RT America television host, Holland Cook. Well, Holland Cook, I got to tell you, the article you wrote in Talkers Magazine about Quentin Tarantino's new movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and how it relates to radio, prompted me to invite you onto this podcast because you took a very interesting angle on it. So before we even start, where do you see this movie now that it's been out for a couple of weeks in the pantheon of movies that impact our culture enough to be talked about in a talk radio setting?
Well, among others making predictions, the LA Times figures that this has got to be on the short list for Best Picture next time they're handing out the Oscars. And it just occurs to me that the way they have used vintage radio air check clips and songs from 1969. This has also got to be a shoe-in for best soundtrack. And as I mentioned in the article, it has been reported that Quentin Tarantino listened to 14 hours of air checks circa 1969 from the late great 93 KHJ. So while a lot of people are going to go to the movies to see what ended up being the last performance from the late great Luke Perry, there's another posthumous appearance here that I think really contributes to the period piece that Tarantino evokes in this movie, and that is the way radio was the soundtrack of our lives in a way that it is not today because of all its interloper new tech competitors.
Yeah, that is true. Radio is not the soundtrack of our lives the way it was. However, if I were making a movie trying to capture these days and I needed a radio background, I would probably have a talk show in the background with a Rush Limbaugh-esque host, or if I really was doing cinema verite, I'd have real recordings of it, depending how far in the future this was, talking about the issues of the time in a talk radio setting. And I think that could give the impression of being the soundtrack of our times. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, often in the movies, we have heard radio used that way. When there are serial murders out at Crystal Lake, we are often treated to the sound of a radio newscaster saying, "In other news," click, and then they turn the radio off, you know, after the report of the latest murder. So if you were trying to evoke something issue-oriented, you could use a Rush Limbaugh clip or a caricature of Rush Limbaugh clip. But if we're making a movie about today in the future and wanted to evoke today, would it be us asking Alexa to play a song? Would it be Pandora in the background? Radio doesn't have the kind of lock on our attention that this movie demonstrates that particular AM station had on 1969 Los Angeles.
Yeah, no question. One other thing about movies that I find interesting is that movies tend to frame reality. And it's all a matter of framing. It's a matter of, you know, form and content, the staging of a situation. Movies frame history in a way that is not accurate, but it feels real when you're watching it. For example, if a scene were to take place in 1969 and they walk into a diner, there'd be a newspaper laying there that says this 1969. The hits coming out of the jukebox would be the hits of 1969.
Sure.
Every car on the road driving by on Sunset Boulevard would be a 1969 Chevy or a Cadillac, you know, Coupe de Ville with a big... In other words, reality, if you went back to 1969 in reality and you walked into a diner, or you went back to 1975, you couldn't immediately figure out what year you're in, because the reality is that every period, when you pinpoint it down to a day, is really a sloshy blend of the couple of years before, maybe even the couple of years to come. That reality is not so framed and so specifically categorized.
All of the above, which you just cited, are what movies and TV calls atmosphere. You know, they're trying to put you back somewhere by creating the atmosphere. And the attention to detail in this movie is uncanny. Tarantino actually included dated-looking graffiti on the street there and other effects. And as you say, they rounded up a bunch of gas guzzlers, so it looked like the cars of then. But this needn't simply be a Valentine to what radio was, because today you've got the big cash-starved, debt-hobbled corporate behemoths dumbing it down with automation and syndication and DJs piped in from the mothership versus the undaunted, often mom and pop operators who crave great programming, have the decision-making authority to make it happen. They can actually buy a piece of equipment or sign a check, and they are hell-bent on seeming conspicuously more engaging than the robo-radio from the big corporate owner across the street. Mm. And not to paint the haves and the have-nots as corporate owners or not, because one of the folks that we interviewed for this piece in Talkers, Dave Stewart, the nighttime jock on CBS FM in New York, his station does this to this day. Even having survived the Jack debacle, where they walked away from the format for a couple of years a while back. But you go in any pizza joint in any borough in New York, and you're going to hear WCBS FM. And it's not a museum. It's not a period piece. It's not trying to reenact the sound of that high band five tower AM station in the 70s like the satellite radio channels do. It is a radio station about today that is playing the greatest songs of the 70s and 80s. But it's a contemporary station with vintage music. And like KHJ is depicted in the Quentin Tarantino movie, there are stations owned by big companies like WCBS FM that still hold that position in their market because they hold that place in people's lives.
Interesting point. You've said a number of things in this last piece of our conversation that bring up of some interesting angles on this. Back in 1969, when KHJ was the dominant top 40 station in L.A., there were some other big stations in L.A. too. They were not the only one. There was Color Radio, KFWB, and there were some, you know, KMPC. There were some big adult contemporary stations. But KHJ was a monster. Was a giant station. It was owned in those days by RKO General, which had KHJs all around the country, and you know, of a similar format called the Drake format, from Bill Drake, who was a big consultant those days. At its peak, RKO General, one of the big corporations, and there was ABC Radio, there was Metro Media Radio, there was Westinghouse Radio. These mega corporations of the 60s and early 70s that dominated radio would have been considered, in terms of their size and their operation, to be mom and pop stations compared to the size of today's post regulation consolidation era corporate giants. They were because I worked at some of them. They were quaint compared to today's radio. I just wanted to point that out to you.
They were the big guys back then. You go down the next level, and who remembers Avco and Susquehanna, mm-hmm. and all the other groups, maybe not quite as big a market as RKO General or Westinghouse. But remember, at the time, they were all as big as each other because the FCC only allowed you a certain rash of stations. Mm-hmm. You could only own seven of them at one point on AM and seven of them on FM back in the vintage that this film evokes. So it still comes down to making the connection with the listener one-on-one, regardless of where you are or who owns you.
I think the biggest problem facing today's debt-stifled mega corporate radio is that they don't know how to go about making great radio on a tight budget and allowing their creative people to have the time to think. One of the things I notice when I hang out or spend time with or get involved in a trench level with the current broadcasting industry is that no one has time to think. That they're constantly, right, they don't have thinking time. And it's almost considered to sit around at work today in that environment, in the conference room, and kick back in the chair, have a cup of coffee, talk with your peers, what are we going to do? Let's figure out a promotion. Let's have a discussion. That's almost considered to be a waste of time. And people are not in the moment anymore. And I guess this goes on in other industries as well, which leads to severe incompetence.
Yeah, they have too much on their plate, obviously. The one program director right. per station era is quaint now. But that's what you had when radio, as depicted in this movie, was the norm. And there was a function on 1270 AM, and that's all the program director paid attention to at that point. And now, as you say, their attention is divided, and it's generational in another way, because the guys and the women who are in charge of making the big programming decisions today aren't old enough to have felt making the mojo back when the radio station, recalled by this movie, was so dominant. And you and I, just having this conversation, sound like the two old guys in the balcony at the beginning of the Muppet Show, because we happened to be there then. Mm-hmm. But it's generational in that way. There's a feeling we're trying to describe, which is tough to describe.
And in our defense, like one must make a defense about being old, but in our defense, for those listening to this conversation who may not know our work, I would say 90% of the work you do and 90% of the work I do, just to show how overwhelmingly a majority of our time we spend on this thing called the future. You and I are among the two loudest futurists in the entire radio industry. So please, folks, if you're listening to this, don't interpret this as a couple of old guys longing for the good old days, because I don't think we could ever go back to that if we duplicated it exactly or even created a reasonable facsimile of it. But
yeah, and I'm glad you made that point, because as Carly Simon sang back then, these are the good old days.
Yeah.
For anybody who bothers and anybody with a will to recapture the kind of stickiness, the kind of mojo that KHJ had as depicted in Quentin Tarantino's film, you better get on with it quickly, because we're counting trees instead of looking at the forest. All the recent gnashing of teeth about the passing of WPLJ and WRQX and WABC are counting peanuts. Here comes the elephant. There's going to be more of this, because these big companies have untenable debt, and they're going to have to keep disposing of these once proud stations just to keep the wolves away from the door. Mm-hmm. So the clock is ticking in terms of viable signals available to recapture that mojo. The Rush Limbaugh show started out on a bunch of stations at 1470 until the competition down at 810 on the dial realized this guy was onto something, and the bigger stick stole Rush. Well, what's 1470 going to do? That signal can't compete with 810. Mm-hmm. So anybody who's trying to put the genie back in the bottle at 1470, it's not going to happen. You need what WPLJ just gave up. You need 95.5 in New York to get heard.
Well, that means you still have confidence that dial position is going to matter in the coming few years. For those who don't know what Holland is talking about, the lower part of the dial was where invariably the bigger signals and the bigger stations happened to be. When you started to get up into the 1270 and the 1410s and the you know, that whole area, those were usually smaller stations, both literally and figuratively. Am I correct in that interpretation?
Well, and that's just the AM band. Back to the future. Now we think in terms of AM versus FM, which is why all the AM stations that are suffering from the snap, crackle, and pop that our iPhones and all this other technology puts into the atmosphere, these AM stations are getting what's called FM translators. They give them FM frequencies that can be heard only in the immediate area to supplement the AM band that people are drifting away from. I think my point, and what comes through when you see this movie, is that it's broadcast radio now defending against IP, Internet Protocol Delivered Radio. I can ask Alexa, play Crosby, Stills, and Nash, but I don't know that anybody has ever asked Alexa, play 6 commercials in a row.
Well, we certainly have lots of that on standard commercial radio. I have often said, and I believe, that one of the biggest problems facing commercial radio today is the commercial, especially when you string 6 or 7 of them together. I'm laughing, but it makes me want to cry. Let's go back to KHJ for a moment and this discussion about how things in a culture change where you can't go home again. One of the things that made the Drake format stations that was so well executed at KHJ, because KHJ transcended the format that Bill Drake created. Bill Drake created a format where all the jocks basically sounded the same. They had big round voices like, you know, I'm Michael Harrison on KHJ. They all had that sound. They could only talk over music. They couldn't talk during naked spots where there was no music unless there was a good reason for it. And what do I mean by talking over music? I'm talking about those long intros or even short intros and outros of records. They talked while records were playing. So between those voices and the fact that music was churning in the background, there was a real fast-paced, mechanical, branded sound. And then they had this overriding jingle that would play at the top of the hour, and it went bum 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 bum.
It was the Motown Orchestra.
You still hear it. You know, the funny thing is, we're talking about something that was big in 1969, but Holland, there are still stations out there with that Drake music. Bum 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 bum. In some places it's kitsch, in other places it's what they do. And then the voice would come on and say something like this. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Big Town Sound on 93 KHJ, or, you know, WXLO New York. And then the jingle singers would say, you know, 93 KHJ Los Angeles. And
yeah,
then
they did a more efficient job delivering the listener what the listener wanted. Radio had it made in the shade. You know, pick a market, any market. WRKO in Boston was the Drake station.
Right.
Attacking comfortable, cozy, homespun WBZ, where DJ Dick Summer told us the playlist was, quote unquote, suggested. Well, along came a music research and all the other technology and presentation pizzazz that you've described, and WRKO out-delivered WBZ. It was instant gratification. You push the button and you get the song. And the fact that the jocks had to keep it moving forced a discipline, which also respected the listeners, because the guys who made the most money could say in 7 seconds what the guys in the smaller markets needed 17 seconds to say.
We saw that at WABC with Dan Ingram, one of the greatest top 40 jocks of all time. Now WABC was not a Drake format. They had their own little version of, we'll have Manhattan, the Bronx, and
we
Staten
all
Island
shamelessly
too.
Stole his stuff. You know, he had writers. And
did he really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he had writers. And the minute I heard him say it, I, too, introduced Elton John on WPRO saying, someone shaved my wife tonight. You know, it didn't halt the momentum of the station. He was that good that he could convey that quickly. So while the Drake format at its inception and in its heyday seemed more military, seemed more disciplined, seemed more corporate than the lackadaisical incumbents that it was attacking, it really did give the listener what the listener wanted in a more efficient fashion. It was a good discipline.
Yeah, and the point of this that really shows the difference of radio then and now was the one-to-many versus the one-to-one. When you have,
hey, Kimisabe, Dan Ingram on WABC, it's Thursday, Stevie Wonder.
Or you hear, you know, the ladies and gentlemen, anything with ladies and gentlemen.
It was a PA system sounding delivery. The antidote to which was, what you were doing at the time with these nascent AOR stations, and you were involved in maybe the two most legendary of all. You were in the building at KMET in Los Angeles, and you were on WNEW-FM in New York, and you'd start talking when the music was over, and you'd stop talking when the music began. It was, as you have said, describing that sort of radio, it was Uncola.
Right. It was the Uncola. Remember, that was 7-Up's campaign against Pepsi and Coke. We were the Uncola. And we were proud of the fact that we were not number one. We were proud of the fact that we didn't talk over the music. As a matter of fact, it was like almost competitive among DJs back on that format. Who would let the last chord of the Sgt. Pepper album, you know, where it goes, boom.
Right. Play the label.
Play the label. Right.
But see, that was a time when we were questioning / rebelling against authority.
Right.
So one radio format was rebelling against another until, of course, the corporate guys smelled money, and then they turned AOR into its own top 40.
And they start saying, what would hurt if you broke in a little earlier when the Beatles chord is fading out?
Or no, they said, these are the 435 songs you really want to
play. That's when it got crazy. It started to chip away, chip away, chip away. And ironically, you know, I was one of the pioneers and gurus of that particular format. But I got to tell you, my love of radio supersedes any of the differences between WNEW-FM and WABC or KHJ and KMET that I lived with in both cities. And I get a huge kick out of listening to DJs talking up to posts and those great jingles and those dynamics.
It's a lost art. But you know what both of the above have in common? Whether it was the buttoned down, tweaked up Drake format, or this budding, this experimental sounding AOR that these FMs came along with. You know what they both had in common? And this will sound like a real consultant buzzword. This sounds like lab coat talk. But what they had in common was curation. You could go out and buy those songs on vinyl if you wanted, but here was a station presenting them for you. And in the case of the AOR stations, it was probably the DJ's choice of music as opposed to the well-researched Drake format. But what they both had in common was that the station was curating the program. Today, people are their own curators because the soft launch of YouTube Music allows me to decide what I want to hear, and it'll play for me more songs that people who like my songs also want to hear. Or I can ask Alexa for any one of 14,000 some songs that I get for free because I'm Amazon Prime. And if I ask her for a song that's not one of those 14,000, she'll offer to bump me up for a couple of bucks a month to 2.5 million songs. But I am now the curator. And what radio's got to do to get the genie back in the bottle is to relate, is to demonstrate the value of letting somebody else put it together for you.
I don't know whether that could ever
happen.
Maybe
the way that Pandora and all these others homogenize things, maybe the pendulum swings back to what consultants call new music discovery. Maybe it's all going to get so homogenized that we just don't want to hear Year of the Cat another time.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it could ever come back. I don't know if radio will ever be able to reclaim what I call its ownership of the music culture. Sports radio has a large degree of ownership of the sports culture. Talk radio has a large degree of the news culture, of the political culture. But I don't know if music radio could ever regain what it had. It had it more than the aforementioned, the other formats have. It owned the music culture. And we used to call it the radio and record industry. No right. S, one industry. It was such a symbiotic balance that whoever thought it would ever get unbalanced. There were the record stores. You heard the song on the air. It prompted you to buy it so that you could play it whenever you wanted it, because you couldn't play it whenever you wanted it, but you knew from the radio that it existed. There's your discovery. And then you knew how it existed relative to the other pieces and how it existed within the culture of you and your friends. It
was as generational as that skill set you're describing is, we are going to run the risk of sounding like old farts needlessly. Why can't we put a man on the moon again? Well, there's two reasons. Number one, we stopped making Saturn rockets. You know, you're going to have to make something else that can shove something that far that fast. And the other reason is because the guys who know how to do it are all dying, you know, the institutional memory. But it needn't be that way. The tools are at our hand, but the company doesn't want to pay for music research anymore. As recently as the 90s, I was traveling around doing focus groups and structuring perceptual research, and now that stuff all just comes from the mothership. Thus, the stations that still have a real connection with the listeners, a station like WCBS-FM, Dave Stewart interviewed in the Talkers article, or Oldies 100 in Washington, where I amused and horrified my friends who only knew me as a corporate suit when I reverted to my DJ past there in the 90s. And program director Steve Allen hired an entire air staff who had never done Oldies before, because it wasn't going to be a period piece. It was a station about today that happened to have the greatest songs of yesterday, but it was about today. Mm-hmm. And we could do that again if the company would just let us.
Well, fortunately, the company doesn't have complete control over every platform anymore because of the internet. So it's happening in other ways. I seriously doubt the company will ever let us do that again. And I certainly don't know if I'd want to be part of us, because I'm so engrossed in spoken word radio at this point that I don't know if I'd even personally want to do it for more than maybe one or two times.
Well, is spoken word radio immune? You know, we're using social media the way that talk radio figured it had a franchise. We don't need the radio to talk to each other anymore. Yeah. That too risks turning into a caricature.
There's no question about it. That nothing as our forefathers, who were as emotionally invested in vaudeville as our generation was invested in either Top 40 or AOR radio, as they learned, nothing culturally is in stone. Even what we consider to be humanity, you know, that's not human. As we look at the age of AI, that is going to make us question what is human intelligence, what is human consciousness, what is human culture. Nothing is in stone. All of this stuff that we consider so important, radio, the Beatles, Lady Gaga, whatever you want to call it, Quentin Tarantino's 9th movie, will he make a 10th? All of this stuff is going to pass away very quickly into new culture that will seem extremely strange to us if we live long enough to see it.
You know, if some gun nut doesn't shoot us first, you know, this is a talk radio imitating itself in this past week. And do they need us to have that conversation anymore? I don't think they do. You know, we have Twitter. We have social media. We can holler at each other any number of ways.
Yeah, well, there's always going to be the balance between what we, meaning the public, consider to be the big watering holes versus the small ones. The individualized one-to-ones and the big mainstream media. I find even right now, in terms of the left-right debate, the conservative and the liberal debate, the Democratic Party, called by its detractors the Democrat Party, and the Republican Party, the use of the term mainstream media doesn't work anymore. The people that listen to, the people that watch Fox News Channel believe that CNN is the mainstream media, and that Fox News Channel is the alternative media, when in fact, they're both mainstream media.
Well, it's, I mean, if you go by the numbers, it's really the other way around.
That's the irony about it.
But, you know, let's not confuse people. We don't want information. We want affirmation. Tell me what I believe is right.
Well, I remember the argument, having been in rock radio when all it was about was speaking to the intelligence and virtues of young people and respecting the musicological artistry of their favorite sounds, you know, the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young era, the Traffic era, the early Led Zeppelin era, the post-Beatles era, where the music was everything, and how as the commercial success began to take over the FM dial and these formats, it became more about playing the music that the target part of the audience wanted and making them feel that it was the greatest thing that ever happened, when already the DJs knew that much of it was crap.
Well, you just put a bow, you just put a ribbon on this entire conversation with a word you said, and it doesn't just apply to radio. Pick a business, any business, but the more respect you show the consumer, the more successful you will be.
And there you have it, a conversation with media consultant and RT America television host, Holland Cook. Holland Cook's website is hollandcook.com, and he spells Cook with an E at the end. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it, as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, the Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a presentation of Podcast One, produced in association with Talkers Magazine and Good Phone Communications. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved.